I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. Imagine a science lab where researchers are growing a human brain in a petri dish. Now, you need to imagine a bit more that this brain might have the capacity to learn or to reason, that it might develop a kind of consciousness. Well, it simply stands to reason that such an experiment would generate all sorts of calls for ethical oversight. Here's another situation. It's now known that IBM and a Swiss lab are off on a new project to build a computer simulation of the human brain, something they're calling the Blue Brain Project. Now, it might take 10 years or more, but scientists are imagining that by then, they may have the same kind of computing power as we'd find in all the cells and all the nerve connections and all the neurons as the human brain. So, what kind of ethical considerations might that cause? I mean, definitions of intelligence and consciousness are always being debated by the top minds in science. This hour, we'll hear what the concerns and questions are. We'd also like to hear from you. Will we ever create the kind of machine that can be considered to have a mind? And if so, will such intelligent machines ever have the right to be treated as a being, as something alive that we have to consider with ethical care? Or are these things always going to be just silicone models, bundles of wires and chips that we can construct and destroy at will? Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. That is 1-800-423-TALK. Marvin Minsky is here with me in the studio. He is co-founder of MIT's Artificial Intelligence Lab and professor of Media Arts and Sciences. He's also regarded as one of the fathers of artificial intelligence. He's the author of a number of books, including The Society of Mind. He is now just wrapping up work on a book called The Emotion Machine. Marvin, it's great to have you here in the studio.
Oh, it's a pleasure, Dick.
And joining us from a studio in Toronto is Brian Cantwell-Smith. He is Dean of the Faculty of Information Studies at the University of Toronto, author of On the Origin of Species. It's a book about updating metaphysics for the modern scientific age. Brian, it's good to have you with us as well.
Thank you. It's an honor.
Can I ask you, Brian, to just start us off here with a layman's explanation of what's new in this Blue Brain Project?
Well, I think it's true that in the past, most of artificial intelligence has tried to simulate the function of the mind or the function of the brain. What's interesting about this case is that instead of going at the function, they're going at the actual circuitry, which is to say at the neuronal level. They're simulating, I think, about 60,000 neurons in the neocortex, which is a fairly small, that's still a million times smaller than the full neocortex, and even that's not part of the whole brain, and that's not part of the whole body. So it's just a small, modest beginning. But the real idea, I think, is to simulate at that level and see what kinds of patterns of behavior emerge on top of it.
So if I were to try and come up with a way of describing this, when you talk about the cortical columns or the neocortex, these are the building blocks, the pieces of the human brain, right? And they're planning on lighting them up sort of like lights on a Christmas tree, but one at a time?
Well, I'm no neuroscientist, so I'll defer to those people who are. But the sense is that I think what biologists and neuroscientists and computer scientists and so on realize is it's really the patterns of behaviors, the timing, the interconnectedness, and so on and so forth. It's really the electrical circuitry or the chemical circuitry that is really what makes the difference rather than the actual materials it's made of. And so if you get the same circuitry, the same kinds of signals flowing around, the same kinds of connectivity, the same kinds of interaction with the world, you'll pretty much have the same thing.
Now, Marvin Minsky, you have been studying artificial intelligence for decades now. Is this project taking us in any new direction?
Well, one of the problems in our understanding of the brain is that we know a great deal about how individual cells work, brain cells, that is. But that doesn't tell us much about intelligence because those brain cells haven't changed much for 300 million years when the first animals began to have nervous systems. And we also know a great deal from psychology about how people think, but not enough to simulate on a computer. So there's a gap. And what we need to know is what happens in the intermediate structures in the brain you mentioned, like these cortical columns. Most of the brain is made up of groups of the order of 500 or 1,000 cells, and nobody knows really what they do except in the visual system, which is pretty well understood, but that's almost the same in other animals.
And so if we try to imagine what it is that the Blue Brain Project might be, would it be reasonable to go back, would it be 13, 14 years now, to the announcement that scientists were heading out on the Human Genome Project, that they were going to map DNA? Are we at the beginning of something like that, where we really don't know where it's going to lead us?
Well, it's similar in some ways, because technically it was a little bit hard to find the coding of all the genes, and we still don't know what most of those genes do or mean. And the same thing might be true for a cortical column. If we can simulate the behavior of 500 cells in a cortical column, it may still take a lot of other kinds of theories to guess what kinds of inputs to put into them and take out of them. And in fact, nobody's ever put a large number of electrodes around a single cortical column to see what it really does. So these people will have to guess, and maybe 10 years of guessing will turn up something good.
I'm wondering, Brian, if you are looking ahead at where this may lead us and imagining some kind of eureka moment where all these questions that Marvin's describing that have bedeviled biologists and physicists and neuroscientists for so long might in fact be answered by this kind of simulation. Is the potential there for that?
Well, two things I think one could say. I think if it's a eureka, it's only the history books that will call it a eureka. I think those of us who live through it, it's going to be much slower than a eureka. The scales are just enormous. So the difference between, for example, you and New York City or something, there are just lots of things that hold of New York City, the neighborhoods, the multicultural profiles, the density, and so on and so forth, which are not properties of an individual. And similar things happen in the brain. There are properties and patterns of organization at higher scales, and we're starting on that trip. I don't think that there's going to be one day when suddenly the computer is going to kind of open its eyes and say hello at all. However, I think your question is exactly right, which is, what are we going to do as a way of understanding what it is that I think we're very likely to build? I don't think the idea of a machine is the crucial issue. I think the real question is, are we going to be able to fabricate the kinds of, in laboratories and so on, the kinds of life, the kinds of intelligence that we up to now have built in other ways, namely by having children? I think the answer is almost surely yes. Not soon, but yes. The question is, how do we understand that? How will we know? One of the things I ask my undergraduate students is, what would have to be true of a computer in order for it to be unethical for you to unplug it? Just to start people thinking about what those real questions of significance are.
Is there an answer to that question?
Well, I'm not sure. This is Minsky. I'm not sure that ethical questions are ethical questions in a certain sense, because you can ask for rules about what should I do now? I have two choices. What's the right thing? What's the wrong thing? But what's the wrong thing now could be the right thing 10 or 20 years later. And it seems to me that most ethical discussions focus on what you should do right now, regardless of what the long-range consequences are. So it's very hard to decide whether to turn off a certain machine or not, or to put a person in jail or not. All these issues, as Brian said, are connected with everything else that happens in society.
Brian, do you have an answer to the question that you ask your undergraduates?
Well, I really want to engage them in the debate more than, in fact, providing an answer. I think one thing I say as an answer is it might be that the question about whether it's unethical to unplug it is the same question as whether we would want to treat it as we. What would it be for us to actually incorporate synthesized life in a notion of we? And I think the construction of we is tremendously important throughout the world, for example, in racial strife and genocide and political debates and so on. There's a question of what it is to extend a sense of we to other cultures and other races and so on. There are people in the environment who are trying to understand what it is to extend a sense of we to the world as a whole. And so what I really want to do is to get debate about that. But another thing, I think Marvin would probably agree with this, one of the things that's been true about the last thousands of years is that the ethical frameworks that we've developed depend enormously on certain facts about our physical makeup. So, for example, murder, which is probably the worst thing that one can do, depends on the fact that if you snuff out a physical being, you've snuffed out the life. We don't take backups of people. If we did backup tapes of everybody every night at midnight, the whole ethics of murder would be different, because if I murdered you, for example, then we might have to back you up until last night and you wouldn't remember this morning and the power outage or whatever. But it would have a different ethical profile. And the thing about the machines we build is they'll have very, very different bodies, different material circumstances. We may be able to back them up in different ways. And what that does is it brings us up against what kinds of assumptions about our physical existence have in fact informed the ethical frameworks that we live with, and what would it be to start adjusting those assumptions? Or perhaps a better way to put it is, what would it be to broaden the scope of those assumptions to include more diverse forms of life?
All right, Connection listeners, when we come back after the break, we're going to try to get some definitions on the table here. We'll be talking about intelligence. We'll be talking about consciousness. We'll be talking about ways of understanding what would be different between the human brain as we understand it today and imagining what a computer could be 5, 10, 20 years from now, perhaps capable of original thought, perhaps capable of being considered as a being and due some sort of ethical consideration that we would never give now to a small robot that simply rolls around on the floor and does vacuuming for us. We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. So what is consciousness? What is intelligence? If it exists, can a machine actually possess those capabilities? And if we're moving towards an age of machines that do some measure of thinking on their own, do we have any kind of an ethical obligation to treat artificial intelligence in a humane fashion? 1-800-423-TALK. With me in the studio, Marvin Minsky. He is the author of a number of books. The Emotion Machine, the one he is working on now, is on the web. You can go and talk to him about it in an interactive way. We have all the links on our own website. We're at theconnection.org, and those links will also bring you to the work of Brian Cantwell-Smith, who's Dean of the Faculty of Information Studies at the University of Toronto and author of another book called On the Origin of Objects. Our number, 1-800-423-TALK, and we're starting in Silk Hope, North Carolina. John is joining us. Hello, John.
Good morning, Dick. How are you?
I'm well. What do you think?
Well, I have two comments to make on this subject. First of all, as a biologist of over 40 years professional work, I'm extremely dubious about the ability of computer people to manufacture anything that approaches consciousness.
How do you define consciousness, though,
well,
John?
Well, you see, that's the problem. We don't have a good definition of consciousness. Biologists are willing to admit that fact. I don't think the computer people are much farther ahead of us. But the second point I'd like to make is, even if I'm wrong, and it were conceivably possible for us to make a conscious machine, it would immediately become the slave of a capitalist corporation, and I doubt very seriously that any capitalist corporation would willingly give up its slaves.
All right, let's start with this first one, because it's a way of letting those of us who aren't scientists into an understanding here. And Marvin, I'm going to start with you on this question of consciousness. Is that a big hurdle, just the definition of the word, understanding it?
I think the urge to define it is the obstacle, because I think we use the word consciousness for about 20 different things. And if you get to look at the draft of my book, Chapter 4 is about that. But the I think we use that word for everything about the mind we don't understand.
That's why you call it a suitcase word. We just pack into it everything.
Right, right. And if you divide it into 20 parts, like remembering what you've done recently, having some slight idea of what kind of reasoning you did recently, just being able to react to things, and 20 other things, if we take each of those, then each of those is a hard problem, but not a terribly hard problem.
So all of those are computing problems, is what you're saying?
I think so.
Yeah.
And if you look at them all as a single problem, then you'll never get anywhere. The word life is a good example, because until the era of Louis Pasteur, people thought there was some very fundamental, simple, incomprehensible difference between living things and dead things. And what Louis Pasteur said, by showing that organic chemicals were just chemicals, he showed that there's an immense complicated network, like the New York City that Brian talked about. And you have to understand what we now know are something like 200,000 or 300,000 relations between different chemicals. So it's a big job. But that's what I call the dignity of complexity. If you understand that something's complicated, then you can start working on it. But I think our biologist friend thinks that there's some magic trick called consciousness, and all we have to do is understand that. And, of course, we can't. Let me just go back to one thing that Brian Cantwell-Smith said, because I think the ethics is related to that question of backup. Did you know that there is a company that backs up the entire web? It's called Wayback.com, and it was made by a friend of mine, Brewster Kahle. And if you ever look on the web and you can't find a page, it's not there, and you can swear it's there, then you type Wayback.com, and then it says, would you like 2000, or it started in about the year 2000.
Right.
So you can say, well, I think around the middle of 2003, and all of a sudden you're on the web 3 years ago, and if you murder the web now, well,
there's a way.
You'd lose 6 months.
Right. Brian, can I come back on a couple of these simple points here, questions of life and consciousness? Because when Marvin talks about the belief perhaps among biologists that there is a little bit of magic in whatever we understand life to be, I don't think that he's entirely alone there. I think a lot of people have this sense that there is that imponderable, completely something that's unable to do for a computer to duplicate.
Well, I think two things. I actually agree with Marvin about the fact that the attempt to define it is an obstacle to our understanding. But I think, as he says, and I think as has come out of, for example, if you read the papers in the Journal of Consciousness Studies, for example, you would get many, many people weighing in roughly the same direction, that it's an extremely complex, diverse, textured suite of phenomena with all of them applicable to the human case. But I think two things that I would say in addition to that, one of them is that one thing that strikes me about consciousness, just in a general sense, is that our consciousness is a kind of orientation towards things that are not necessarily here. For example, I might be conscious of events going on the other side of the planet, or events, just as Marvin was talking about, events 3 years ago or something.
Is this the capacity to imagine? Is that what you're talking about?
Well, all those things, the capacity to imagine, the capacity to actually take there to be a world out there rather than just a whole set of signals impinging on your periphery.
Right.
If you just study the kind of mechanical structures, you're likely to sort of reduce everything to a question of how you deal with the inputs and outputs. But the amazing thing is that if I ask you what you're thinking about, for example, what you're conscious of, you don't talk about, oh, I'm conscious of this light impinging on my retina. What you say is, oh, I'm conscious of that Volkswagen over there across the field, or I'm thinking about the party we had last weekend or something like that. So that orientation towards what's distal is just a word for what's, you know, a long way away or remote in time, space, possibility, and so
right.
on. That's a very interesting characteristic of that orientation towards the stuff that's a long way away. And whether you're right or wrong,
that we, that's the part that we're imagining a machine could never do, Brian. Is that incorrect in your view?
I think it's incorrect. I think that... See, I stumble on this word machine. I don't know what assumptions people have about machine. I think machine is about as difficult a word as consciousness, actually. And some people think, oh, if it's just a machine, then, you know, certain things must be true of it.
I get you.
Maybe it's owned by a corporation, or maybe it just runs electricity, or who knows what they think a machine is. I think the real question, though, is can we construct things that will, in fact, be oriented towards the world outside them? That's a really interesting part of the problem.
I'd say it's also important to do the opposite. For example, I can think about what I was recently thinking about, and I can say, oh, that was a foolish conclusion that I came to. I think I'll try another approach. What's a good analogy to that? When did I make a mistake of that sort? So I think that the focus on distal things really leads you away from the important parts of thinking, which is remembering what you did recently, thinking about whether a certain kind of thinking led to good results or bad. Did you represent the Volkswagen as a vehicle that you use for transportation, or did you, when you saw it, did you think of it as a bunch of mechanical parts or electrical parts or so forth? And whether we are conscious of it or not, I think most of our mental activity is thinking about what we've been thinking about and its interior. When Christopher Reeve lost his body, so to speak, he got smarter, as far as I could tell, not deprived.
Let me bring another voice into the conversation here. Paul Davies has been listening along. He's a professor of natural philosophy in the Australian Centre for Astrobiology at Macquarie University. He is himself a theoretical physicist and a cosmologist and an author. Paul, it's nice to have you with us.
It's my pleasure.
I'm wondering if in your mind it's possible to rise above our inability to define all these words and get at the issue where we started. Should we, will we ever be trying to make ethical decisions about the intelligence created by computers? Now I'm hesitating to use the word machine, but that kind of intelligence as opposed to what we already know.
I think the distinction between what used to be called natural and artificial is going to soon disappear, I think within a generation or so. So the fact that you might have produced a micro machine as a component from a living system, or you've built it in the lab from scratch, nobody's going to much care. And the same will be true eventually of the mental realm, that whether you grow a brain, whether a brain is produced in the normal, traditional method, or whether you build something in a lab or combine all of these together, we're not going to really care very much. And so therefore, we obviously, in the longer term, have to think in terms of these ethical issues.
Okay, but if the distinction between something that's natural and something that's artificial will disappear, does that mean that my grandchildren won't be able to tell the difference between their playmates and robots?
I'm thinking, first of all, at the level of micro-machines.
Right.
The living cell is full of micro-machines and nano-machines, and some of these are being extracted and combined with artificial, what we would call artificial devices from the lab, and hybrid systems are being created and so on. So this distinction between what has emerged by evolution from the natural world and what human beings have made, it's going to go away because there is no clear dividing line between the living and non-living realms and between the conscious and non-conscious realms. I don't think it's very productive to try to separate these things out. Now, when it comes to consciousness, there is an additional issue, I must say, that has not been touched upon in the discussion so far, and that issue is what David Chalmers, the Australian philosopher, chooses to term the hard problem as opposed to the easy problem. The easy problem, to use the technical term, is mapping the neural correlates. If I think about a dog, which bit of my brain lights up, what goes on there, and so on. Now, in principle, it's a very hard job, but in principle, we could imagine mapping the brain to the level of detail where we would pretty much know what went on physically corresponding to certain mental activity and experiences. But this doesn't address the hard problem. What is the hard problem? Well, it's what philosophers call qualia or qualia. When I look at red, I get this inner subjective feeling of redness that for me is completely different from the sensation of greenness or the sound of a bell or the feeling of water. These qualia are for me completely different. But of course, it's an internal experience. It's not something that we can display to the outside world. I can respond to these qualia, but you can't enter into my consciousness and see my sensation of red or green. And so I think a lot of scientists feel that this will be forever intractable. And in fact, some philosophers prefer to try to define qualia away altogether as a non-problem, because it seems that it will forever lie outside the scope of traditional scientific inquiries.
All right,
to that extent, I think consciousness will always remain a mystery.
Lots on the table here, but lots of people who want to join us on the phone as well, 1-800-423-8255. Let's go to Watertown, Massachusetts. Michael is on the line. Hello, Michael.
Hi. First, a brief joke that if you take too long doing this, eventually the question of whether this thing is conscious or not will end up being decided by the Federal Department of Religious Orthodoxy, and they'll just give you an opinion the way things are going right now. My main question was, assuming we've got something that's conscious, will we be able to say anything interesting to it? I mean, this relates to the question of, you know, we've got bodies, we need food, we need air, most of us know we're going to die, and we have certain conditions in our lives that come from all these things, and which may in fact help add up to the particular kalia associated with particular perceptions. So the question is, if this thing is conscious, will we have anything of interest to say to it and it to us?
Well, that's the point, I guess, Marvin. Will it have anything interesting to say to us, this idea of original thought rather than something that has been programmed into it?
Well, I think that's an artificial distinction. If the machine is constantly thinking about what it's been doing and revising it, of course, every time you make a change in your mind, you're taking some risk, and you're not the same structure that you were before. But I think all of these issues are important in some sense, but if you look at the long-range consequences, I think there are more important issues. Pretty soon, I think, unless something goes wrong with our civilization, the average person is going to live for 200 or 300 years. We could go into a long discussion of how that could happen. One theory is that we live twice as long as chimpanzees, and yet we're only different from them in a few genes, or a few hundred genes.
How does that change the way that we regard what's real and what's artificial and what's... I'm not going to say the machine word, but you're...
well, I think one thing is that also in that period of the next 100 years, we'll be able to duplicate ourselves. And I don't want to argue that about the hard problem Paul mentioned, but I don't think qualia is a hard problem. I don't think the question of how we react to red and green is any harder than the question of how we differentiate between touching the little finger on your left hand and the thumb on your left hand. It's the secret of the so-called hard problem is that if it's like consciousness itself, if you think of it as you want a single magic explanation of how we feel sensations, but if you break it into 50 pretty hard problems, then the hard one goes away. But another problem is that we're going to need these robots in any case. When people live 200 years and we start controlling the population on the planet, there'll only be one young person for every older person, and we're going to need these intelligent assistants to do all the work. And so that's a side issue, but it's important.
Brian, let me just get you to jump in here on our the distinctions that we're messing around with, the easy problem, right, the hard problem. Do we have these kinds of answers, do you think?
Well, I don't think we have the answers. I'm as actually concerned with the spiritual issues, the ethical issues, the political issues as anyone here. But I think that the advocates of the people who defend the idea of there being a sharp distinction between the easy and the hard problem, I think actually don't understand what Marvin was talking about the dignity of complexity. I really think it's if I had to reduce what we've learned in artificial intelligence in the last 30 years to one word, it would be humility. I think we have a tremendous sense of how much can emerge from complexity that doesn't strike you as something that would emerge from those ingredients. But I also want to mention a thing that Michael mentioned. I think that was the name from Waterton. I do think, with respect to what it is that we have to talk to these people, to other people or to machines about, I'm using the word to just
that's
allow
okay.
it to be used.
You're allowed.
I think it's true that a great deal of who we are, what matters to us, what we've come to be, and so on, depends on our embedding in the world, the kinds of lives we lead, the connections in, and so on. And I think, in fact, before we get a system that we build that's interesting, we're going to have to embed it in the world. It's interesting that, to some extent, if you were to you said, oh, I don't know, James Joyce wrote amazing novels, let's simulate his typewriter. just because he wrote them on a typewriter doesn't mean that the typewriter is interesting. It's the information that flowed through the typewriter.
Brian, I'm going to have to stop you there. We have a break coming up. I'll use this opportunity to thank Paul Davies for being with us. Paul's a professor of natural philosophy in the Australian Centre for Astrobiology at Macquarie University. We're back after the break. I'm Dick Gordon. Dick Gordon, you're listening to The Connection. What is consciousness? If it exists, can a machine have it? Will we see a machine with consciousness or a soul sometime in the next 10 or 15 or 20 years? We began the program by talking about IBM's new Blue Brain project, where they're actually working on the simulation of a human brain, and that has launched us into areas of ethical consideration. We'd like to hear from you. We're at 1-800-423-8255. We're taking a call from Baton Rouge, Louisiana. Brandon is on the line. Hi, Brandon.
Hi, how are you doing?
I'm fine. What do you think?
Ultimately it's the machine. I hate to use the word machine, but it's the computer's ability to self-sacrifice without being backed up, to give it a more human trait, or if you would, a soul.
Explain what you mean by self-sacrifice.
Being willing to destroy yourself to save another, and not only for humans though, but for other animals and whatnot.
So that's a moral decision then, right?
In a way, yes. Yes. I guess you would put it that way, yes.
Well, I'm struggling, as everybody here, with the words that we're using. Brian, is that a measure then of intelligence, the ability of some collection of silicon and wires and chips to make a moral decision?
Well, I think the caller has a very good point, that there's something related about whether we treat these systems as ethical beings or as moral beings, and whether these systems are capable themselves in making moral decisions in treating us as ethical. That's really underlies my notion of we, that matters so much. As this system emerges, it's going to have to develop its own ethical commitments in order for it to warrant our having an ethical commitment to it.
But how can it develop its own ethics if the only thing that it has to work with are the ethics or the ideas put into it by the designer, by the scientist?
Well, I think that's a very this is, again, I like Marvin's phrase, the dignity of complexity. I think the idea that if you build things out of pieces, the only thing that can emerge is what the designers put in, that's part of the humility we've learned in the last 30, 40 years, is it just isn't true.
Mm.
Once you build a certain level of complexity and it starts interacting with the world, getting bumped and shoved and reconfigured and so on and so forth, there are, you know, early in the days of AI, there were programs that came up with geometrical proofs of simple geometrical theorems, which astonished people. Certainly the designers had no idea. The chess programs that, just to go back to the Deep Blue as opposed to the Blue Brain, came up with moves that people hadn't imagined and so on and so forth. So I think the obstacles to understanding are really at play here again, that we somehow have, this is one of my troubles with that word machine, is thinking that we understand it. If you simulate the biology, the system may be conscious whether we actually understand what consciousness is or not, and we may actually have no plan to put consciousness in. It may just emerge.
Brandon, what about that idea that when you take all these component parts and put them together, you're actually creating something other than the sum of all those parts, and that may be the kind of soul we're talking about?
Well, I think that's
sorry, that
true.
Was for Brandon in Louisiana.
Oh,
Brandon, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here. I think that's one of the beautiful parts of the whole adventure of creating another life form, almost. I mean, it's extremely mind-boggling at times, and it's surprising in the results. And I think it's an endeavor that we should definitely keep proceeding upon, you know?
Is that a reasonable litmus test, the one that Brandon has given us? Can this collection of whatever parts it is make a moral decision, an original moral decision?
Well, so far as we know, it takes only a few parts plus a lot of memory to make a computer that can do everything any other computer can do. That was actually discovered in the 1930s by a couple of mathematicians. But I like what Brandon said about the great adventure. If we make these machines There's no reason to expect them to be very much like us. If I take all the theories I have of how human thinking works and build a program a machine to do those things, it's certainly not going to do what I expected because it's so complicated. And in fact, the first 100 or 1,000 versions of it are going to not work at all because they'll have some kind of internal parasite. But Brandon's pointing to the great adventure of this research. We don't know if we're ever going to meet extraterrestrial aliens from other places because the universe is so big and the speed of light is so slow.
And but we ought to be thinking about it, and we ought to be talking about it just in advance of that.
Certainly. And, but I think in this field of artificial intelligence, we're almost certain to meet lots of aliens that are a little bit like us and very different from us, and that's going to be the great adventure of the next 50 years.
Let's take another call. This one from Louisville, Kentucky. Michael's on the line. Hi, Michael.
Hi, how are you?
I'm fine.
I wanted to say I'm a programmer, and I have been for a long, long time, and anyone who programs computers, at least normally, realizes they're most of the time dumb as a box of rocks. I mean, it's there's not a lot there. But recently, for the first time ever, I was making a program that was a tic-tac-toe program using a neural network, which is an AI technique for, you know, this. It was very simple, but it was a complete epiphany. I've never in my life written a program that, I mean, I wrote it. It did not know how to play tic-tac-toe. There was no logic at all. And initially, of course, it was totally clueless when you started playing it, but then you let it play itself 10,000 times, and at the end of the training, it knew how to play tic-tac-toe perfectly. It was a complete epiphany moment. And then one of the things that you've been talking about a lot of...
Did it change your own definition of what we call intelligence?
Yes, it did. It was clear to me that while, you know, you can spend a lot of time talking about human intelligence and going that far, but here was something that was intelligent. It figured out how to play tic-tac-toe, and I didn't tell it at all. It was quite an epiphany.
That raises a wonderful kind of issue, because I once tried to teach my daughter tic-tac-toe, and I think she must have been only 4 years old, and she kept not completing the three in the row. And finally I said, "Why are you doing that?" And she said, why don't you try to win? And she said, "If I go there, the game will be over." And she learned exactly how to make the game last as long as possible. And I hadn't intended to teach her that.
This is one that you can add to your list of questions for your students then, Brian, I suggest.
That's right.
Our number is 1-800-423-8255. And where are we off to next to Natick, Massachusetts? Brad's on the line. Hello, Brad.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. This is really a great show.
Yeah, what are you thinking?
Well, I guess I also am a computer programmer, and this is actually a good point in the program for my question. I kind of wonder if artificial intelligence and the search for, you know, understanding its principles is just sort of a special case of us trying to understand how the other natural phenomena come into existence, what some people would call self-organization.
Give me an example of what you're talking about.
Well, Stuart Kaufman, who's a writer who's written about the, like, for example, the evolution of life, raises the question, well, how did that type of a complexity arise? And there are a lot of examples in nature where, you know, simple elements combine over and over and over again to create very complex phenomenon. I guess my question is, it goes back to this question of will there be an aha moment or some great epiphany by some scientists? And I guess I kind of wonder, and I'd like to hear your guest respond to the idea that, you know, it might just be that some mathematician sometime in the future comes up with a better framework for self-organizing systems, and a number of these questions become easier to answer.
But are you also, Brad, imagining a time when that kind of a system becomes so complex that it creates its own personality, that, as Brian was saying earlier, you can't unplug it without making some kind of an ethical decision?
Well, I mean, I think one point earlier made that, you know, is that we consider unplugging something or ending something to be, you know, a final thing. But, you know, given the nature of the technology, you might just be able to back it up, turn it on again next week, and it would not, you know, it would, things would continue. So I don't definition of ethics would change in that type of situation.
Brian, let me hear from you on Brad's point here.
Yeah, I think the issue that Brad's getting at it really points back to this idea of an adventure, and I think the point is that the adventure is an adventure of our imaginations as much as it is an adventure of our technologies. And I think the reason for that is that there are different levels at which we can understand a system. So take a person. Take you, Dick. Suppose I had magically delivered to me a list of all the differential equations governing the movements of the atoms and protons and electrons in your brain, you know, 100 gazillion volumes of it, say, but it was all here. And they said, look, this is Dick Gordon. I wouldn't learn anything. I wouldn't learn anything about your curiosities. I wouldn't learn anything about your ability to host this program or anything. It might be a complete description of you, but it would be at the wrong level. I just wouldn't get at the interesting issues. And I think the point about self-organization and the point of this project of IBM's is, what's the relationship between our understanding things at different levels of description versus what kinds of phenomena we actually unleash? Those may not go together. And that's, I think, one of the things that's so impressive about these self-organizing systems and these neural networks that the caller spoke about, is that you can understand it at one level, and then it comes and surprises you by behavior that's understood at a different level.
Brad, is this what you're talking about here?
Exactly. We don't seem to have any general mathematics or theory for self-organizing systems in general. And I think that it is, and certainly, first of all, it is a great adventure, an intellectual adventure, for us to try and understand these things. I think it'll advance science in a couple of areas, as I sort of alluded to. So I think it's a great intellectual adventure.
Let me try and look at it from a different perspective. And Marvin, I'm going to ask you to help me with this. Right now, in this country, there's a great debate on that begins with stem cell research and takes us on to imagining cloning and the cloning of human organs or the cloning of humans and what that will mean and all the moral and ethical issues that are tied up with that. Why is it that artificial intelligence is not a part of the same questioning and wondering and imagining? Are people not putting this on that same level yet?
Some people are, and even in the 1960s, there was a book about why artificial intelligence is a terrible threat to humanity and so forth.
But that was science fiction in the 60s. Maybe not to you, but to so many people that they couldn't even conceive of, you know, what we call machines having human capabilities. Now we seem to be getting closer to that.
Yes, and there are people who are warning us, certainly. One person is warning us that we shouldn't investigate nanotechnology because it could produce new kinds of micro diseases, and there are people who say we shouldn't make artificial intelligence because it might take over the world. But I'd like to talk about the caller's question for a moment, because he suggested that we need a theory of self-organization.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's a suite, as Brian Davies said, or a suitcase word. What we need is to take the word self-organization, which is very popular, and try to say what are the 10 most common kinds of self-organization. Because, in fact, in general, if you make a big complicated system, nothing good comes out of it. If you get a lot of parts and you connect them too closely together, you get a huge traffic jam. And if you get a lot of parts and you don't connect them very much, then nothing happens. And there's a sort of mathematical theory of if they're connected just the right amount, then interesting things happen. And there's a field called nonlinear mechanics in mathematics, which studies what kinds of things happen at these wonderful boundaries where things are just rich enough to produce other things.
But isn't that the point that Brian was making about you understand it at this level, or you understand it at the next level, or you take it apart and you put it back together at another level?
Right, and different things happen when you make very slight differences in the big architecture of the system, and over the next 1,000 years, we're going to learn more and more about it. There were some really good theories started by the great mathematician Henri Poincaré in the late 19th century, and he was the first one to see that very complicated things could come out of simple ones. That became something called chaos theory now, and there are lots of mathematicians trying to classify the different ways systems can organize themselves. Anybody listening who's a young person trying to decide what to study, that's a good field.
Brian, let me just hear from you on these questions. Are we making a mistake by not trying to create some kind of framework to have an ethical conversation about what these machines are to become? Or are you satisfied? Are you thinking, yeah, we're...
Oh, no, I'm not satisfied. I actually think this is tremendously urgent. It's interesting, Dick, because it comes up in your comment about how there's all this public debate about stem cell research and so on, but there isn't much debate about machines. What I think is likely to actually be the place where the questions are in fact urgent rather than in an imaginative way, but are actually real, is actually in the cyborg realm. So, for example, Carver Mead at Caltech has been developing silicon circuits that replicate or simulate, whatever word you want to use, the structures of the retina and the cochlea. You can imagine a retinal implant to cure blindness, and then you decide that, well, gee, as long as we're building it, let's make it sensitive to the infrared. And it's just a coincidence that our eyes aren't. So people with that implant can see better at night. And then some insurance company decides to give them lower rates because they have fewer accidents. And then 5 years later, someone suggests we should have a law that those of us with the old-fashioned kind of retinas shouldn't be allowed to drive at night because statistically we're killing and maiming people. It's going to be a really complicated situation for the people who are growing up now. And I think it's really going to be... The place it's going to take place is in this sort of textured middle in between. You know, it's not going to be a question of an R2-D2 in the corner and an untouched person in the other corner. It's going to be this complicated, messy interplay that is where the ethical questions are really going to come home to roost.
This is like the old definition of my father's axe, my father's favorite axe, which he's replaced the handle on 3 times and the head on twice. It's still defined
That's
as
right.
his old axe. Brian,
That's
I want
right.
to thank you so much for being with us on the program today.
Thank you, Dick.
Brian Cantwell-Smith, Dean of the Faculty of Information Studies at the University of Toronto and author of On the Origin of Objects. Marvin Minsky, it was a pleasure having you here in the studio. Thanks so much for your time. Marvin Minsky is co-founder of MIT's Artificial Intelligence Lab and author of the forthcoming book, The Emotion Machine. If you would like to find out more about what my guests are thinking and working on, you can go to our website. We are at www.theconnection.org. Our senior producer is Tara Murphy. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.